This is Dr. David Stevens, your host, on another issue of Christian Doctor's Digest. It's always great to be with you. And, you know, it's fascinating to me. We just finished our strategic planning with the board. And as part of that, we reviewed the results of the survey we did recently of our members. And it was great to see that Christian Doctor's Digest is actually the most favorite resource that our members have. I know you enjoy it, and I enjoy doing it because I get to talk to some fascinating people. And that's true in this issue as well. We're going to start off with a favorite of everyone, and John Patrick's going to join us to talk about how you reach the young through apologetics. He's going to give us some insights you'll get nowhere else. And you know, one of the things I really love is the testimonies of what God has done in individual lives. And we have two fascinating testimonies from our members that are going to inspire you and encourage you and equip you in your walk with Jesus Christ. Well, let's get to hear what John has to say. Most of you know John Patrick, but for those of you that may have forgotten some of his background, he's a British-trained physician. He's done extensive research into the treatment of childhood nutritional deficiencies and related diseases. He's held appointments in universities in Britain, the West Indies, and in Canada, where he retired as the associate professor in clinical nutrition at the University of Ottawa. He's also done projects in Central Africa in training programs dealing with childhood protein energy malnourishment. But most of you know him as an apologist, someone who can explain Christianity to others and to us who are Christians in ways we've not heard it before. I know he's impacted my life. I know he's impacted many of yours. Just recently, I had the opportunity to sit down with him. And in the midst of that conversation, I turned to John and said, John, tell me what you've been thinking about. What's God been teaching you? And here's how the conversation went.
There's been one really quite interesting phenomenon for me, which sort of crept up on me without me being aware of what was happening. I was in BC, in Vancouver, a few months ago, basically to do part of a course on the official schedule with the university, which included distance education on other campuses. But somebody who follows me in some way noted I would be in Vancouver, and I got this call saying, we're running an apologetics conference in Chilliwack, which is up at the top of the Fraser Valley, just before you get to the mountains. And he said, would you come? And I said, sure, I can do that. What do you want me to do? He said, well, we have nobody to help young Christians talk about the issues related to medicine that they get into trouble with at school. I said, oh, that's no problem. I can do that. And I didn't think anything about it. I didn't ask him how big it was going to be or who was going to be there. I was a bit flippant, really, I suppose. But when I got there, I think it was approaching 1,500 people.
Wow.
And they'd come from as far away as Montana. That was a bit surprising. I mean, some of the other speakers were very well known, but I was totally unprepared for this. And, of course, I was an unknown quantity since I spend most of my time with doctors. But there was a real intense interest over, I suppose it was 3 days. And then shortly after that happened, I got a call from a Baptist guy in Campbell River who said, I was at the conference in Chilliwack. We're running a similar one, and I see you're going to be in Edmonton anyway. Could we tag on to that and have you come to us as well? So I did that. And then during the summer, I had my first experience of being involved with Ravi Zacharias, and they had an apologetics conference in Hamilton for Christians who want to learn to argue the case. And I was stunned. There's something happening.
Wow.
And, of course, part of it, we see our own students when we send them off to university really turning the pressure up on the secular environment. A lovely example, this academic year, one of last year's grads starting a year in pre-med. And about 6 weeks into the course, a professor teaching the biopsychosocial aspects of medicine began his lecture with the first overhead saying there are no absolutes. And Nathan immediately raised his hand, which, as you well know, doesn't normally happen in first-year university. The guy looked up and said, yes, what's your problem? And he said, sir, is that sentence internally consistent? And there were enough people, as quick as you, in the audience amongst the students who started laughing. Some of them, of course, didn't understand what was going on. But the guy himself was both smart and sensible. He realized he was thoroughly beaten, so he did the only thing you can do. He climbed down graciously. He said, I suppose I should say thank you. It is a foolish sentence. I must remove it. Thank you. But, of course, that led to lots of conversation. But he thought, I'm bound to get hammered for it in Marx at some point. There will be revenge, which would normally be the case, but there wasn't in this case. In this particular course, they do quite a lot of small group stuff, and they have to do a joint presentation in pairs to show that they can work together and make a presentation and include one another, you know, that sort of thing. And after this episode, a Muslim girl came up to Nathan and said, she'd been in this small group. She said, I like the way you treat women, and I like how smart you are. Will you do your presentation with me on some aspect of sexuality? And he said, yes. What about Reichardt's Bitter Pill? I don't know if you know that paper. It's the first economic analysis of the effect of the pill that I know of. And it's a stunning paper. It's an academic paper, but the point can easily be made. Basically, Reichardt argues that the net effect of the pill has been to transfer money from women and children to men. And he's got the data to prove it. So they talked about what the pill had done, both economically and why it had worked, which is, we can talk about that if you want to in a moment. But when they got to give their presentation, who was the invigilator but the guy that he had previously taken down? And he said to the Muslim girl, we're not going to get good marks, you know. But the guy actually gave them maximum marks. He said, first of all, for courage on taking that subject on. And secondly, because you did it excellently. So there's something going on when, you know, Muslim girls come and ask Christian boys to present on sexuality. When not 10 or 20, but over 1,000 turn up to an apologetics conference, and it sold out both the Chilliwack one and the Ravi Zacharias one. They were turning people away. So I'm thinking a lot more about churches and how we... I don't think we've done as good a job interacting with churches as we should. I mean, people like Joe McElhane have provided the material, but I haven't done a good job. I'm sure you've done better than me, but I think we could do a lot more.
Yeah, I think so too, and I think they need that. I mean, because often, though they have great biblical training, they don't know how to apply it into the medical, bioethical, social issues that we deal with in medicine.
Have tended to be too nice.
Yeah. What else is going on? I mean, what else you've been thinking about, reading about? We always learn from what you've been learning.
It's always books. I can't remember when I last talked to you on Doctor's Digest.
Probably been over a year ago.
Well, I'm not sure when I picked up James Calve's book, The Tyranny of Liberalism. Is it a new title to you?
It is.
Yeah. Okay, then I probably didn't do it last time. I don't know a great deal about the man who wrote it. He's a lawyer in New York, but he's written a very, very interesting book, basically elaborating on some of the things that I do, but putting them in a broader perspective and doing it very well. You can watch at the moment in your politics how people whose hearts are in the right place get hammered in the public square, largely because they don't understand what the nature of the argument is, and so they're easy to portray as ignorant, whereas in actual fact they're not. But they are a little lazy in dealing with the basic issues. The subtitle of the book says most of what it's about. It says, Understanding and Overcoming Administered Freedom, Inquisitorial Tolerance, and Equality by Command.
Wow. It's a mouthful.
It is, but that is what the liberal elite take as given. And we don't attack them on those points, which are, in fact, very attackable. And so we lose because they've controlled the thought patterns of society now the process goes back to the Enlightenment. It's three centuries or more. So that students are frightened to say, I am intolerant. Whereas if they stop to think for a moment, they could realize that 10 commandments are 10 things that God will not tolerate, or at least you could rewrite them in that form, couldn't you? And it is that framework of what we will not do that actually provides for the freedom. that our society used to have. But because we no longer have that base, now we have to have bureaucrats telling us we are to be free in this way, but we cannot be free in that way. They don't look upon freedom as we do, freedom to be what we ought to be. In the wonderful Anglican prayer book phrase, whose service is perfect freedom. I mean, that's a paradox, isn't it? But you and I know that it's true. It is only when we truly submit to the Lord's ways that we are truly free in ourselves to be what we know deep down we ought to be. And so I think this book would be any of your guys that you're sending out to take on the liberal elite would do well to read it. It would give them some insight into what we're dealing with and why we so often lose. They define freedom as lack of interference. We define it in an entirely different way. They look upon tolerance as a primary virtue. We ought to look upon it as an administrative technique, which is what they do. The best book on that is A.J. Conyers' book on tolerance, a prof at Baylor. He's dead now, but he wrote a superb book, giving you the history of how it all came about, which is very useful when you're arguing with somebody who claims to be well-educated.
Mm-hmm. So what are the main points on how you deal with them? I mean, if you had 10 minutes to tell somebody how to deal with what they're seeing in the public square and hearing in the public square, based on this book and your own knowledge, what would you say?
Well, the first thing is ask questions, don't make statements as far as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, say, take abortion. You know my approach, but it's a good example. Don't go for abortion. Go for the idea, what would you need to believe to be an ethical abortionist? What are you saying about the meaning of human life and therefore about the meaning of your own life when you espouse this way of solving a problem? And, of course, the only way they can get out of that is by saying, well, we live once and that's it. Life has no eternal meaning. And then you can say, well, what if you're wrong and it does? And of course, in the history of the world, most people have thought there's more to it than meets the eye. From the Greeks all the way through, it's only in the last 300 years or so that we've tried behaving as though that is not true. And look at the mess we're in. So that's number one. Ask questions and get them to think about what they're taking for granted. But they expect when they say you are intolerant that you will fold up and say I'm very sorry, and I say, well, that's an interesting statement. There are things I'm intolerant of, but presumably you're not tolerant of child abuse, so you're intolerant too. So should we not discuss when it's appropriate and when it's not, rather than this sort of blanket politically correct everybody must be tolerant? The things we ought not to tolerate, it's not good for the people who are doing it, and it's not good for us, and it's not good for society. What I'm saying, of course, is that if we're going to do a decent job, we've got to do a bit more reading so that we can talk about our understandings of freedom and justice and tolerance and how they have put equality as the objective of every exercise, whereas the Bible is very clear. We're all different. We're equal in God's sight as his creatures, but he has made us for different purposes. And where those purposes are concerned, he has equipped some for one thing and some for another. We all have a role, but to say that we're all equal is stupid. It's clearly untrue. We're different. Now, we have duties that we should all obey. Ultimately, for the Christian, it is whatever our abilities, they are should be at the service of our brother and sister. Love is what we call it. But I still, sadly, when in my travels, meet people who never made their way through Lewis's basic works, and have not met Peter Kraft, have not read any Leslie Newbegin. The people who can really help you to understand what the university does to you. I mean, we know, we do this in the eight-month program at Augustine, and the kids who take that course, they flourish in university and they can take their profs on like Nathan did. He's not alone. Interestingly, we've had a fully-fledged doctor take the course for the last 2 years.
Hmm.
One from Norway that I met in Uruguay at the ICMDA meeting. Lisa Gilbert, who's an American, who's taking 8 months off to do our course because she says, I want to do mission work and I think I need it.
Uh-huh.
And it's a joy to watch what happens as they meet all sorts of people who said and thought things centuries ago that they know nothing about and they wish they did.
How's Augustine doing? I know I meet more and more people who've either been there, want to be there, or are going to be there.
We're not getting enough people, though.
Huh. Well, if people want information, what do they need to do?
Well, it's very countercultural. So you're asking them to do something which requires courage. And that we do get extremely interesting students. One of them this year is a medical student from Arizona who had, she just felt that the medical school course was missing something. And she went searching through the web and found us on the web.
Wow.
And there she is. A Christian who was really rather lonely and is delighted to have found somewhere where she can get some sustenance. But we've had parents who've been to us, and they've tried bribery and corruption even to get their children to come. But many of them are they're like you, a straight arrow. And you went through medical school with the objective of getting to the mission field as fast as possible.
Right.
Now, looking back, God knows what he's doing, but there would have been some benefit to you having a bit more liberal education before you went.
Absolutely. And even more so ended up the fact of where I ended up.
Yes.
You know, there's one thing to be in the hinterlands of Kenya dealing with tribal groups versus, you know, on the public platforms we have now. But I think it serves people well wherever they go, and especially into as missionaries as they're trying to penetrate into Hindu, Buddhist, Muslim areas. It's just essential.
I had a lovely time when I went to Tenwick this year.
Oh, I didn't know that.
You didn't know I'd been to Tenwick?
No.
Oh, yeah.
You found me still wandering around there, in at least spirit.
Oh, your ghost was everywhere, yes. But the really interesting thing was, the reason I went is that Dr. White sent his son Adam to us the year before.
Oh, wow.
And he wanted me to go anyway, so Sally and I went. We had a lovely time, and we also spoke to a missionary retreat at Mombasa afterwards. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing was a delight. But as you say, what brought it to mind is there's so many things that missionaries always say the same thing. Why didn't I learn that before?
Right.
I mean, how many missionaries of the evangelical persuasion have ever been sat down and said, okay, you know about how people come to Christ, or more precisely, how Christ comes to people. But what comes next? Why were the epistles written? Does conversion make you good? And of course, the answer is no. So what does the Bible have to say about how people are going to be not only brought into relationship with Christ, but able to become his ambassadors to the world to make it a better place? Now, that Christianity has made the world a better place can easily be done. The historical data is overwhelming. And yet I find Christians who are taken in by Dawkins. Mm. I don't understand that. David Hart's Atheist Delusions just takes him to pieces. But then you read John Lennox and people like that, and he takes him to pieces. Yet so many Christians are basically reading the New York bestsellers list. That's stupid, with respect.
I agree with you, and it's so easy, especially when you have all the academic requirements of continuing ed and keeping up with the journals, keeping the specialties, then you're reluctant to take something serious on in a field is just as, if not more important than what you're doing medically. Obviously, we need to be competent, but at the same point,
yeah.
We need to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. And if we put half as much training into that as we put into our profession, where would we be?
Exactly. I mean, when I look back on my own career, I wandered in the wilderness for 20 years because of a failure in this direction.
Yeah.
And when I list my six things your children must be able to deal with before they go to university, parents invariably say, please go through that again slowly so I can write them all down.
Mm-hmm.
But most years, by the time the students have finished my course, I get them to write an essay on reductionism. Some of the essays I've got are absolutely stunning. And every year, one of them points out an example of reductionism that I'd missed entirely. And this year was really very funny because one of the students pointed out that one of my own interests, nutrition, is reductionism. Because what God made was food. What we talk about is nutrition. And actually, if you get food right, you get nutrition right, because God knew how to make food.
Right.
But you go into evangelical homes in North America and snoop in the kitchen cupboards, and there's hundreds of dollars worth of supplements.
Mm-hmm.
What's that saying about food?
Yeah.
And about God's ability to make it? No one in my family has ever taken a supplement.
And our discipline to eat it, as we should.
Yeah, you eat good food, you don't need it. We do have one in Canada, in that the milk is fortified with vitamin D, but that's because, as Trudeau said, really Canadians ought to be in the Caribbean for a month every winter.
Yeah, I don't think anybody would argue with you with that. That would solve that problem.
Yeah.
Well, John, it's been great to talk to you. Always stimulate our thinking. You always give us great resources. You always make us want more, and that's good. We never get enough, and I want to thank you for your dedication over, I don't know, how many years has it been? It's been almost as long as I've been at CMDA.
It was somewhere in the late 80s or early 90s.
Yeah, 90s. Because when I came on at CMDA, somebody handed me your Myth of Moral Neutrality tape. I was traveling, driving up Midwest somewhere, and I listened to it three times and called you after that. And that's how this whole thing began.
Yeah.
With, you know, you were doing some speaking then, but it kind of blew up when that happened. And your life has not been the same since.
That's an understatement, yes.
Yeah. But you were faithful to answer that call and to meet the need and minister to us.
You know that faithful hardly comes into it, does it? It's such a pleasure.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pure grace in our lives. God could do it all without us, but he lets us do these things. And you've really made a lot of these things possible. The college would not have survived if it hadn't been for the contact you've given me with American doctors. There's no question that was absolutely essential to survival.
John, thanks again for being with us and all that you've done for the kingdom.
It's been a pleasure, as it always is, and it's nice to be able to point out that American physicians have made most of this possible for me, and they have certainly been absolutely critical supporters of Augustine College, which is, I urge them to send us some more students, that's all.
Yeah.
But God bless you.
God bless you. I know you love John Patrick as much as I do. And, you know, the thing with John, you can listen to him again and again because it's just almost impossible to internalize everything he says from just one or even two hearings. And we've got a lot of great resources of John. One of the ones that I really appreciate the most because it was the first one I ever heard him, and that was The Myth of Moral Neutrality. It's in one of our Just Add Water videos, and it goes on with another presentation on Much More Than a Baby Dies in Abortion. If you want to hear an articulate presentation on abortion that would just click with a secular audience, that was one you need to get. And then for those of you that are hardcore, we have The Best of John Patrick, Volume 1 and Volume 2. These are 6 or 8 CDs in each volume with multiple talks from John. Man, if you've got a long trip, this is what you need. You'll be traveling along with your intellect stimulated and your thought process going, and the miles will go by. Those are available through Life and Health Resources. You can go to cmda.org and get them, or give us a call. It's toll free at 888-230-2637. I got a call from Dr. Ed Reed, who's our area director in Richmond and an ER physician part-time. And he said, you need to do an interview with Eric Edwards. And he began to tell me the story, and I was fascinated. Eric just graduated from medical school. When he graduated, he already had 130 issued or pending patents. He had not only gotten his medical degree, but a doctorate in pharmacology. And in the midst of going doing all this, he started a company with his brother, who's his identical twin and an engineer. And their products are already on the market. You'll recognize them as you get to this interview. This is a wonderful time seeing what God can do through a young man who's totally committed to Jesus Christ. You're going to enjoy this interview. Eric, most guys don't take 10 years going to medical school. What happened?
Yeah, so I had a detour along the way. So I started in 2003, but prior to beginning medical school, my identical twin brother and I had been pursuing this idea. And it was a unique kind of story that led us to this business venture that we have. And it really began years before I started medical school. As I was entering my undergraduate education, my brother and I were taking a trip to Europe. Now, at the age of three, we were labeled some of the most allergic children our physician had ever encountered. We grew up allergic to all seafood, peanuts, tree nuts, and most antibiotics. And unlike many individuals who may have one of those allergens that is really severe that could lead to anaphylactic shock, we had the potential for anaphylaxis with all of them. So back in the early 80s, growing up with these severe allergies was very difficult, and we had to have an epinephrine auto-injector with us at all times. But like many, we sometimes struggled in being adherent to our doctor's recommendations that we had it with us. And this was the case as we were heading to Europe. We were huge soccer fans, and we were going over to the World Cup, and we thought we had left our auto-injector at home. So as we're about to eat our way through all these different foreign countries, a discussion ensued. We're trying to place blame on one another for the irresponsibility, but fortunately, we were blessed to have a mom who was always prepared, and she had packed extra epinephrine auto-injectors. But out of that discussion in the car that day came the idea that we would try to look into designing and developing a new epinephrine auto-injector option. And that began it all. So Evan went into engineering. Evan's my identical twin brother. And then I was heading down a pathway towards medicine. I had always been passionate about patient care. I had volunteered with the local rescue squad as a paramedic. And so a lot of the ideas for the unmet needs as it related to emergency injectables came from my experience there. But we started our college careers. We were looking up in our undergraduate bulletin certain courses that could help us. He in invention and design, and then myself, I would take some medicinal chemistry courses. And the idea for IntelliJect was forged then. And then we finished our undergraduate careers, and then we learned from the FDA, right when I was beginning medical school, that this was going to be regulated as a pharmaceutical product, not a device, through a new drug application, and that we were going to have to raise the financial resources and the capital to build a drug, do clinical trials, and all of that, which we had no experience with at the time. And so it quickly got bigger than what we ever imagined as we began with this idea for this new epinephrine auto-injector solution. And I started medical school, then took time off, and then did second year, took step one of the boards, and then took additional time off and did a 4.5-year PhD in pharmaceutical science, and then decided to go back and finish my medical degree, and all the while working on pursuing this endeavor with my brother to come up with a new solution for the millions at risk of severe allergies.
Eric, most kids can't hardly get through medical school. you're inventing a new medical product, which obviously there's a lot of folks that like to do that have had a lot more experience and backing than you guys had when you were starting out. I mean, how in the world did God let this happen? Because I guess to jump ahead, it just went on market a few months ago.
Well, you know, I think you said it right. It was we really believe the entire program from day one it has been divinely inspired. The people, the relationships, the ideas, everything associated with this product and this company, we really attribute it to God and His provision. You know, I have a Jeremiah 29:11 sitting on my desk. It says, "For I know the plans I have for you, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future." And I see that every single day. And through every barrier we faced, through all the trials and tribulations, we just knew that He was there along the way and enabled us and used us as a tool to really get through these tough challenges and hurdles of getting a drug approved by the FDA. And it's just been an amazing, amazing journey. And it all starts with him and then the people that he's placed in our lives, the relationships that we've forged, and the much smarter individuals on the management team who have come to be here at Intelliject, many of which also feel this is divinely led, and all of which share that passion for patients and trying to really do something different.
Tell us some of the challenges, but before you do that, just describe the device, because most people may not even be aware of it, even though they probably are going to be pretty soon if they're dealing at all with this area, because what's so new and different? And I know some of those answers because I went on the website, but share with them about it.
Yeah, so AviQ, and we partnered with Sanofi, who is our commercial partner in the U.S., and it's called Allerject in Canada. So it's AviQ in the U.S. and Allerject in Canada. It was developed really using patient input. And what we mean by that, it's more than just market research. We feel like in order to really create a product that can be used by individuals afflicted with a variety of conditions, you really need to put them in the center of development. And so that's what we did. We went out and created a product where the patients told us what they felt the needs were. And in this case, they told us they wanted a product that was portable, that was small, that was easy to use, and that really was safe and could provide them peace of mind during this anxiety-ridden anaphylactic reaction. And so what AviQ and Allerject is this credit card size. It literally is the length and width of a credit card. It's the thickness of a small cell phone. Epinephrine auto-injector that provides a single dose of epinephrine. There's the 0.15 milligram and 0.3 milligram dose, just like other epinephrine auto-injectors. And it has a retractable needle, so the drug injects and then immediately retracts within seconds. And then a unique feature that we have incorporated is it provides audible instructions for use, where an individual, once they remove the product from the case, a voice prompts and assists in guiding a user through the injection process. And we really got this insight talking to patients and realizing that for epinephrine auto-injectors, you may be trained when you're a young individual or you're a teenager, but you may never, you may not have an anaphylactic reaction for years later, or you may be dropping your child off at a babysitter, their grandparents' house, and really have that concern. Are they going to be able to use this in an emergency? Have they been trained correctly? So we had this feature incorporated in, and it's been very well received. And again, we let the true experts, the patients themselves, tell us what they wanted to see in an option. And we're just very blessed to be able to actually now have it FDA approved and on the market, available for physicians to prescribe. So it's been quite a journey.
So tell us some of the challenges and how God helped you through them. I can't imagine. I mean, all the steps involved, from the financing to design to studies and on and on.
Yeah, they're numerous. So I think you hit on a few of them. You can imagine being 21 and finding out that we're going to have to raise enough money to build a drug and a device, and then go through the trials. So just attracting the capital resources first and foremost, you know, that barrier. God has just been amazing. I'm blessed to have a loving family, a mother and father who just always encouraged Evan and I to pursue our dreams. And they took financial risk on our dreams and on this idea. Our whole family really spent time and effort in the beginning. And then, you know, it's funny, in the investor community, you hear this term angel investor. And we had some true angels who really stepped up, and many of those individuals are faith-driven individuals who saw that we were just trying to do something to help individuals afflicted with allergic disease, and really took a lot of risk on us as really young, inexperienced individuals who were just passionate about this idea, and they believed that God was going to see us through this and provide us with the people who could complement our passion with true experience and industry experience. And so those certainly were barriers on the capital side. You know, a couple others that you just don't realize going into it are just the significant challenges around creating a pharmaceutical and making it stable at room temperature, and custom manufacturing and creating manufacturing that never existed before. All of these things were barriers along the way that we just never anticipated. But I think that's one way that God works through your life, is he knows exactly what trials you are ready for.
Mm.
And he doesn't throw them all at you at one time, or you may give up prematurely. And so I think that looking back, if we would have known what we were getting into, I don't think we ever would have moved forward with it. But God knew exactly what trial and what we needed to go through, what barriers we needed to surmount. And he knew that he was going to provide us only with enough that he knew we could handle, and no more, as long as we trusted in him and prayed and allowed him to work in us and through us, that we were able to surmount them and overcome those obstacles. So it's been amazing. And then there's the other ones around, you know, we were faced with a unexpected lawsuit that was brought on by one company, subsequently acquired by the largest pharmaceutical company in the world, and we made it through that, and then all the rigor around the FDA approval. So, you know, it's been a very tough journey, but we've been able to overcome these obstacles through his leadership and us really looking to him. You know, it reminds me of another verse that's one of my favorite verses. It comes from Ephesians, and it says, "Now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine, according to his power that is at work within us." And that really is how we lived our days, knowing that his power is at work within us, and we just need to allow him to do his work on his time schedule, not ours. We would have loved to have had this product out years ago, but you know, we need to allow him to work through us and within us on his schedule, through his power, at his timing. So it's been really, really an unbelievable journey.
I know you were very much part of the CMDA group there in Richmond. How did that group support and encourage you through this? Because, I mean, obviously there are other people on the sidelines rooting you guys on as you ran this race.
Yeah, thank you so much for asking that question. I tell you, the CMDA has been so instrumental in my life personally as I've gone through this balance. And it's a work balance, life balance, and a school balance. You know, I'm married and have three children, two of which have severe allergies as well. So you can only imagine the passion as a patient, and then what happens to that passion when you find out that your three children have even more severe allergies. So, you know, it really was exponential. But the CMDA, from the very beginning, from my first small group Bible study I had, I knew that, you know, I'm going to get through medical school, and I'm going to be surrounded by individuals who are like-minded, who have a kingdom mindset, and who are going to be able to just walk along my side and help me through the rigors and the difficulties associated with the medical education. And it's been amazing, from the Four Fridays fellowships and just having Ed and Debbie move down to Richmond and build the CMDA organization here. There's so many lives, countless lives that have been touched as a result of that. You know, Debbie has a book out that's called Prescription for the Doctor's Wife, which you may be familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple of stories in there that I know reflect my wife and I are the subject matter. And, you know, that just the side-by-side spouse ministry, for my wife to be able to have individuals who she could be alongside, pray with, and be in biblical communion with as I'm going through medical school, and as these other spouses are going through medical school, it just was unbelievable the difference that made every single year, and especially the years through medical school and during my clerkships. So the CMDA has just, it's had a profound impact. My first medical mission trip was through the CMDA. We took a trip to El Salvador, and Ed Reed had been asking me for years to go, and I just used every excuse in the book to not go.
That's hard with Ed, isn't it?
But you know what? His persistence just, it paid off. And when I went, I mean, it was one of the most life-changing experiences I'd ever had. You know, you come back and you really are humbled, and you realize that no matter what God's done in your life, you keep your eyes on what's really, really important.
You touched on it, but I know this was a challenge for your wife, Autumn, and the kids and all that going on during this time. And I'm sure the wives are wondering in a little more detail how in the world she coped with this. It's bad enough having a husband in medical school, but starting a business and doing research and all the rest that was involved in this endeavor. I'm glad Side by Side was there and the Lord helped her, but how did she cope?
Yeah, I mean, there were days where it was very, very tough. I think any physician can relate to the fact that when you have a spouse, especially a spouse who isn't in the healthcare profession, it's tough some days to be able to communicate effectively and to just try to make sure that you're able to relate on certain things. Sometimes you're on your way home from a very busy day and you're just wondering, what should I tell her and what should I not tell her as it relates to what I just went through? Do I want to bring those burdens home, or do I just need to focus on the family and focus on us? And equally for her, I think that our spouses have the same challenge, you know, when they see the stress that you have as a medical student, especially when you're in your clerkships or you're studying for an exam. They don't want to burden you with everything that's been going on in their lives. And so I think that it's a tough balance. And if you don't surround yourself with individuals who understand what you're going through, and if you don't rely on each other's faith and communicate with each other often, but then also pray together. I tell you, my wife has been better than me at making sure that we really prayed together as a couple so that we could get through the difficult challenges or get through the stresses or whenever things got really heated and we weren't on the same page, being able to stop, reflect, put it on God, and allow Him to work through our relationship. So there are definitely always going to be challenges, and especially as it relates to pursuing a medical education and getting through that, even moreover, as we were going through this business and venture, because sometimes we just want to stop and say, Lord, they're being so patient, and I feel like it's all about me right now, my goals, my education, my desires. I need to give it back to them. Lord, when are you going to allow me to do that? Because you get through your first year, and you're like, okay, maybe I'll have more time in second year. And you get through your second year, and again, it repeats the cycle. And I can only imagine for those individuals who enter that residency, and then finally they're thinking, maybe it will end, and I'll have the time for my family they deserve and fellowship. But then they get the fellowship, and they're like, gosh, that isn't any better. So all I can say is it's all about communicating with your spouse and relying on resources such as the CMDA and other individuals who have that kingdom mindset who can pour into you and pray for you and be with you during those difficult times. And certainly that was the case for Autumn and I.
Harry, what's next? You've crossed this finish line, but I have a feeling you're entering other races and you may already be in them. So what's on the agenda? I know visionaries, and they usually don't stop.
Yeah, well, we have a saying here at IntelliJect that we a lot of times feel like it's the end of the beginning. And we've said that after numerous milestones, but we certainly feel that way as well currently. I tell you, we found out recently that just a month after our product was launched, we had saved three lives.
Wow.
Or the individuals who had used our product attributed our product to saving their life. I should say that. But just to understand that people are using this product and it's potentially life-saving has been unbelievable. So we're taking that same passion and that patient-centric approach, and we're allowing God to use the individuals in this company and ideas to work towards other areas where we feel like there are unmet needs, where we feel like we can create life-saving or life-enhancing technologies and really, really do some extraordinary things in patients' lives. So my plan next is I'm going back into the company full-time, and I haven't closed the door on practicing medicine altogether. I'm looking at various options to figure out, is that an area where I want to continue to potentially keep that door open. But for now, I'm going to, you know, give more time to my family.
Right.
And work at the company, trying to create more life-saving products, and then we'll see what happens after that.
Eric, if you were going to tell everyone listening one or two things that the Lord's taught you through all this, what would you say?
So the first one I would definitely say is that, you know, it's his plan, not your plan. And it's sometimes really, really tough for us to grasp that. Sometimes we want it to go in our direction on our timing. And I've had to learn over the years that it never works that way, and that he is at work, and to just trust in him. And when something is thrown in front of you that looks insurmountable or it looks almost impossible, he may have put that obstacle right there in front of you for a reason that only he can understand and appreciate, and for which you will know why at a later date. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is just the power of prayer. And, you know, having that relationship with him requires that you have diligence and giving it to him in the morning. The first thing you do when you wake up, when you're driving to work and you just don't know how it's going to go, giving it to him first and just saying that prayer, how much that can do to really set the stage for the rest of your day. My wife has taught me that. I used to really focus on praying in the evening before I went to bed. And I'm still learning that there's a lot of power in making sure that we give them the first of the day, not just our leftovers. So that's something that I've learned, and then praying constantly and communicating throughout the day when you run into a tough situation, that can be very, very powerful and allow you to really recenter your focus on him, even at work and even in those environments where you feel like it can be challenging to allow him to work through you.
Eric, you've given us a wonderful challenge and a great testimony of God's faithfulness. I want to thank you for taking time out. I know your busy schedule, and we'll all be praying for you that God's going to continue to use you as light in the field that he's called you to, and that he'll continue to teach you as he teaches us as we walk down the path he's put in front. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for all that you all do there at the CMDA.
There's a couple things I want to give you a heads up on. One is CMDA's got a brand new website. We've been working on this for a long time, and it's needed because our website had gotten so huge and unwieldy. By the time you get this, it should be out, if not within the next couple of weeks. And we're excited because it's easier to use, it's more attractive, it's got much more interactivity. You'll be able to do registration online for GHO and MEI trips, conferences, all sorts of things. Actually pay your dues automatically, so you don't have to worry about getting all those letters and thinking, have I paid yet or not? Even set up regular giving to CMDA to be a regular supporter. And we're trying to make things as effortless as possible for you with your busy life. But check it out. You'll find some great new resources at cmda.org. Hey, listen, while you're there, it's not too late to register for the CMDA National Meeting, April 24th through 27th in beautiful Green Lake, Wisconsin, a gorgeous resort. We've got some wonderful speakers in store, but what you will enjoy the most, because we know from our surveys that's what our members appreciate the most, is the networking with other people, meeting your colleagues from across the country, having the opportunity to sit around the table and chat at every meal, great opportunities for relaxation and conversation, and being spiritually renewed at the same time. Why don't you come and, hey, bring a student or resident with you? What a great opportunity to mentor them and introduce them or a colleague to CMDA. Those dates are April 24th through the 27th in Green Lake, Wisconsin. Go to the website and register today. You know, I'd like to spend some time with you and your spouse if you're married. We're going to have the annual CMDA trip to Greece. We'll be gathering in Thessalonica, Greece on September the 27th, and the tour will go through the 6th of October. This will be a life-transforming trip for you. I know it was for me. Why? Because of our guide. We have one of the only three evangelical guides in Greece who has a profound knowledge of archaeology, history, ancient Greek, and the Bible, and he will make Acts and the epistles come alive for you. I've never learned so much about the Bible in a short amount of time as I've learned on that trip. And not only will we be going by bus through some of the Pauline sites, Thessalonica, Athens, Corinth, Philippi, but also taking a 3 or 4 day cruise through the Greek Isles, spending time at Ephesus and Patmos. It's going to be a very enjoyable time. Why don't you check it out? Go to CMDA's website. You'll find everything you need to know about the trip, and you can register there. I hope to see you. We're going to have a great time. Okay, our next interview is about money. Now, don't turn off Christian Doctor's Digest. You know there's a lot in the Bible about money. And we're going to talk to one of our members who's gone down a different path with his personal finances than you may have experienced. It challenged me, and I suspect it's going to challenge you. Let me introduce you to Jason Dykstra. He's a Calvin College graduate, got his MD at the University of Michigan. He's a diagnostic radiologist in Holland, Michigan. He's very involved in mentoring, especially with high school and college students. He and his wife have two adopted children, and they're very involved in advocacy for those exploring adoption or experiencing infertility or undergoing financial difficulty in doing that. Speaking to college students, graduate students, and residents every opportunity he gets. And he's got a great book called Healing Hereafter, A Thorough Biblical Exploration to make sense of numerous difficult faith questions. Let's hear what Jason has to say about money. Jason, it's a delight to have you with us on Christian Doctor's Digest. I hear you have a little different approach to your own financial management than probably most physicians. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that, how it started and what God's done in your life?
Sure. Well, I had the blessing, and God gave me the blessing of numerous role models from a financial standpoint growing up. There were a lot of generous people I knew, many of whom weren't doctors, but also generous people in the medical profession as well. So that was always a background as far as just kind of training me and preparing me to maybe look at our finances a little bit differently than the world typically does. But where it all came to a head was during my third year of medical school, when I was talking to an ENT resident, and he was simply dreaming, as we all do during the training process, about what we would buy and enjoy once we got done finally. And he looked at me, and I kind of naively told him that I was going to have more of a conservative financial strategy and then try to give more money away. And he simply told me that I would not do it, that I wouldn't succeed, and that I would live according to my means, whatever those means ended up being. And I think God used that as a challenge, really. It never left my mind. And ever since then, finishing medical school and residency and into my attending years, I always really wanted to prove him wrong, essentially, and do something different. So the way that we modeled our approach once I was out of residency, besides just typically tithing as a Christian would, was to sit down with my wife and I and to discuss how much it is that we really felt like God was calling us to live off of just for our own needs and simply to give the rest away. And we chose the U.S. median income just because we wanted to experience life at that level and understand people that had to live on that much or less. And, of course, that's a lot of money to a lot of people still. So there's no real level at which people should choose, I think. But the whole principle was to follow the example of the story that Jesus gives his disciples about the widow and the rich people coming to the temple giving gifts. And although the rich people are not condemned for giving a lot of money, they also kept a lot for themselves, whereas the widow, of course, is condoned for keeping nothing, even though she gave less as well. So we feel that how much we keep is just as important as how much we give, and I think that that's a financial role model that any human being can live according to, depending on their means.
You know, Jason, that is interesting, because I almost had a chuckle when you talked about the other resident because we're all so competitive in medicine. You know, and somebody says you can't do that, you go, okay, I'll show you I can do that. That's, at least that's me.
Sometimes God uses competition, I think. So.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. There's godly competition, and to take that dare and make it happen. So what's been the result of that? Because I know it hasn't just been something that you all have done quietly, but God has used you to talk and challenge others through what he challenged you to do. And then what have been the results of that type of lifestyle? Let's start there. What's been the results of that type of lifestyle? And then we'll move into the other part.
Absolutely. Well, speaking to others about it has really come out of the results, because the results have been just absolute joy. And so what we've seen in being able to kind of divert just a huge portion of our income to those in need and to other things has very practically first resulted in us being able to pay off our debt unbelievably quickly. Some college debt, med school debt, obviously, and other debt within just a 2 to 3 years. And so that's obviously a nice hook for anybody in the medical profession
sure.
who's drowning in debt as well. And that's specialization specific, obviously, but it was just amazing to have that kind of freedom. But more from a bearing fruit standpoint, just to be able to look up organizations, find charities that are not just charities supporting causes we like, but organizations that are really using their money well, to research that, to really know that God's money he's given us is going to a good spot, and to be able then to support them substantially has been a huge blessing. And we, of course, get follow-up information from them telling us where that money is going and what it's doing. And oftentimes you can pick that yourself with these organizations. But to have the combination of knowing that a significant portion of what God has given you is going to the people most in need, and to know that it's being spent very well, has been a great blessing. And so we hear stories all the time of how that money improves lives and improves the quality of medical care, but also other types of aid to these people. And it really, no material possession or experience really can beat the joy and fulfillment that comes from that. So that's one of the areas of fruit and benefits that has resulted. The other is simply that we have money in reserve all the time to be able to help those in our own lives that we encounter personally. And so I work with college students a lot, and so whenever they need help financially to start up a Bible study or to go on a missions trip or to just kind of start up or participate in any worthy endeavor, it's so easy to be able to help them simply because there's a huge chunk of our income that we don't consider to be ours, and it's just ready to give them. And also there's a great deal of medical missionary support that we're able to provide, and we really actually feel then part of the team of those going, because intentional senders are a realistic part of that team. So all of those things, and of course we see the fruit of those things personally as we talk to our friends and those that we work with. So all of these things honestly just produce a joy and fulfillment that we have never been able to find and can't find in any other, I guess, use of these resources.
Yeah, it's so easy to think that it's what you have or things that you, quote, can enjoy. Unfortunately, oftentimes those things begin managing you instead of you managing them.
Right.
You have to take care
so.
Of them and all the rest of it. I remember when we came back from Kenya, we had, I think 10 suitcases and 2 boxes, and that's it in the whole world. I never felt freer in my life.
Yeah.
You know, it's very true, and giving yourself unselfishly and of your resources is just a great blessing. How do you manage that? Do you put your money that you're going to use for the Lord's work in a separate checking account or fund that you keep things segregated? Just tell us the practical side of that. If somebody's listening and say, now, exactly how would I do that?
Sure. Well, the first practical thing to do is to think about this in the training process or early in one's career. So for those who are still at that level and not making a much larger income, the best thing to do is simply prepare your mind for that kind of lifestyle so that when you do get done, there's not this type of satisfaction spending and decision-making that traps you into a difficult standard of living that's hard to retract from once you're there. And I call them decision points for those that are making that transition between residency or training and being in your career. And those are basically what house you buy, what neighborhood you live in, and what social circle you surround yourself with. Because those decisions are made very quickly within the first few months of one's career, and the mindset for making those decisions happens even before that, obviously. But once those decisions are made, once you have a set of friends or a social circle or a neighborhood that really kind of prompts you and encourages you to live at or even above your means, it's very difficult to break away from that. So an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, of course. And so those are the best practical ways to get into this mindset early on. But even those who are out, just the practical way we do it is, again, to set the limit that we're going to live at, which for us is the U.S. median or less than the U.S. median income. And then every 3 months, we simply go through our expenses and make sure that we're on track for the year so that we don't get way behind. Mm-hmm. Anything that we have donated to charity or to some other charitable cause, essentially, gets subtracted from that. And we just make sure that we're on par for the year. And then, of course, at the year end, we do December to December. We calculate everything and make sure that we have spent, you know, less than our set income on ourselves. And that's a really fun time because we're able then to actually see the numbers of what has gone to other places. And, of course, you're reviewing all of those contributions at that time as well. So it's just a really blessed time to see how much God was able to take and use to all these different people and organizations. So it's just a reminder. It's not a prideful thing. It's not like we have it all figured out and do it better than other people at all. It's just a really great time of joy to realize, you know, where God's resources have gone and how they've been used all at once.
What's been the impact on those you're with, your colleagues? I know you do a lot of work with students and residents and clear down into college student. What's been the impact on them as they learn of this?
Well, I think the big thing for the younger people is that they're excited because right now they're living at or less of the standard of living that we're living at. And many times they simply think, hey, I can do this. I already do it. I'm enjoying my life. I don't feel like I have to have this, you know, huge increase in my standard of living. And so for them, it's more exciting than anything because they don't have to pull back from anything. They just have to anticipate what God might do through those resources. And part of that involves building that mindset, converting it from one of a satisfaction kind of a mindset once I'm done to rewarding myself to a mindset of, hey, you know I was happy back then. I know I'll be happy now, and I'll have all these extra resources to very practically and fruitfully benefit myself and others, really. So that's been one fruit is just excitement. And with other people, too, I think for the first time they kind of get a glimpse of what that life looks like that's kind of not trapped at a higher standard of living. And so for those that I've talked to who have been out in practice for a while, just to kind of have that spark put in them or that thought put in them that, wow, you know, I've seen what the material life can be, and quite honestly, it hasn't fulfilled me. And you know, it kind of gives them that interest and a mechanism for them to be able to kind of pull back from that and really experience that joy and fulfillment that maybe they thought they would get from their current standard of living. And it's obviously harder to backpedal, but at the same time, I think there's a fulfillment and a joy that people anticipate from that I think God intended us for.
I think it's very true, and I've seen that happen in folks that, you know, divested most of what they have and gone to the mission field or done something like that, but you don't have to go somewhere else to take this step. You just wrote a book. I want to hear about that. It's actually a different topic than this one, but tell us what God put on your heart.
Yeah, thank you. You know, like I said, working with students for the past 11 years, I've encountered a lot of difficult questions about the Christian faith, and actually the students' parents ask a lot of questions too, and these are high school and college students. So over the years, I've put down written responses that are straight from the Bible, very biblically based for these folks, just in my own personal study and also just from what I've learned from pastors and scholars and so forth throughout the years. And after a while, I had 50 to 100 of these, and there was a large discussion a few years ago on God's plan for us and if it makes sense or not, and that discussion has continued in the more general populace. And so I thought, you know, this is a good time to really put these all together. And so the book is called Healing Hereafter, and basically what it is an approach that uses just the Bible to look at about 100 questions that we all ask about God's plan for us, about the afterlife, about heaven and hell, and brings them all together in one place to try to make sense out of his plan. A lot of times books will deal with only the top 10 kind of difficult questions, or maybe they'll provide an overview of some difficult questions, but not really provide a lot of closure. So this book is meant to be kind of a one-stop shop for these difficult questions, bringing them all together to make sure that the answers we provide still make sense when they're taken together, but also to give people some closure on some of these doubts and questions that many people just assume have to be a part of the Christian life. And it's written really for Christians or non-Christians. There's questions that only either group would ask in the book. But it's been a hugely wonderful journey for me just to make sense of how what God tells us in his world. And it's also been really beneficial for a lot of people that have given me good feedback about how it's cleared things up for them that they never could figure out otherwise, biblically.
If people want to get copies, how can they do it, Jason? I know you have it as an e-book and a paperback book, both.
Sure. No, the easiest way is to go to jasondykstrawrites.com. That's JASONDYKSTRAWRITES.com. And you can learn more about the book from there. You can learn more about me and my family from there. One aspect about the book that has a lot to do with what we're talking about is simply this principle of keeping less and giving more. And so 100% of the proceeds from the book go to various charities such as Compassion or International Justice Mission, Bethany Christian Services, and Bread for the World. So many of these are medically linked, some of them are not. But they're all great organizations that are known to give their money very effectively. And so even by buying the book, you're simply supporting what we're talking about and using our resources for charitable causes.
Well, Jason, I want to thank you for letting God use you to speak to us, not just in your words, but more importantly in your commitment and your life, and for the way you're ministering to others, not just financially, but through your time and energies to touch students' lives. So may God bless you richly as you continue to serve him, and I look forward to getting a copy of the book myself, so I'm going to be the next purchaser. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. And I just want to make sure that everyone knows that we don't feel like we're doing this as some sort of a show or put us on a pedestal. I mean, this is just something we were challenged to do by others and by God. And I love that it can be applicable really to anyone wherever they're at. But also that it's really the amazing joy and fulfillment of this kind of a mindset that I think people are missing out on when they don't take a challenge like this. Thank you so much for the opportunity to share, and God bless you and all who are listening.
If you'd like to get a copy of Jason's book, you can go to his website, Jason Dykstra Writes, all one word, jasondykstrawrites.com, or you can go on Amazon, Healing Hereafter, and you just put that in the search engine on Amazon, and you'll get Jason's book. You know, as I was thinking about these interviews, we just have some great examples of radical living. In fact, one of my favorite books is the book Radical by David Platt, Taking Back Your Faith from the American Dream. It's a great resource to get us out of the rut. You know, when I used to live in Africa and we had rainy season, there would be these deep ruts and trucks going through, and you dropped your wheel in one of those, and it was so difficult to get out. And that's kind of like you and my life are. I mean, we're busy, we're doing good things, we're doing ministry, we're doing medicine, we're touching people's lives, but it's so easy to get into a rut and just be doing the same thing over and over again. We're not really living by faith the way we should. I've been thinking about this in my own life. Like you probably do, I have my devotions every day. I have my prayer list. We're involved in church. We're involved in choir. And it's easy to get comfortable. I was thinking about this in November. We did our first global health relief outreach. Working with the Salvation Army, we went to the Philippines to answer the tremendous needs from Typhoon Yolanda. A couple of my staff thought they were going to lead that team, and due to some others' commitments, they couldn't go. And just within a few days, I found myself in the city of Tacloban, where a 15 to 17 foot tidal wave from that typhoon had just swept through the city, knocking down buildings and trees, winds of over 200 miles an hour, just devastation almost like a nuclear bomb. I mean, it was just unbelievable what the power of this storm had done. And even though we got there about a week after the thing had happened, they were still pulling bodies out of the rubble, thousands upon thousands killed. In fact, when I left 2.5 weeks later and the next leader came in, they were still pulling decomposed bodies out of the rubble. The misery, the devastation, no electricity, no clean water, hospitals destroyed. It was tough. We lived in a partially destroyed building, sleeping on the floor. The heat was 100 degrees and the humidity was 95%. Dinghies carrying mosquitoes in swarms. I never put on so much insect repellent in my life, and they still could find any square centimeter that you weren't covered. We didn't have clean water. We didn't have lights. We were eating dehydrated food. It was a challenging time. There were many times I thought to myself, I'm getting a little old for this. But you know, I'm so glad I went, because it was radical. It made me dependent on God in a new way. And I saw God work in me and through me, and my faith was strengthened. See, even though we have our regular times of charging our spiritual battery, so to speak, that really doesn't accomplish everything unless we put that battery where it can do some good, where we're living radically and on the edge, trying to touch people's life. And that's how our faith grows. Our faith grows when we take that step. You know, it's faith along the way. It's power along the way as we follow Christ. We see examples of that in the Bible, don't we? We think about the Israelites coming out of Egypt, and Moses had, you know, been having this battle with Pharaoh. And finally, Pharaoh says, okay, get these people out here. I can't take any more of these plagues. And the people were so glad to see the Israelites leaving that they gave them clothes, they gave them jewels, they gave them gold, and off they march. Wow, what a party, almost like a picnic. And they get down towards the Red Sea, and what happens? Pharaoh changes his mind, and he sends the National Guard after them, his chariots, and he's going to destroy them and force them back into slavery, because he knew the economy was going to be destroyed without this free labor. And they look back, and they see the cloud of his chariots, and they're despairing and angry with Moses, and why have you done this? And what did God say? God said through Moses, just keep going. Just keep going. Put your next step. Go down to the Red Sea. Now, this looked like it was impossible to get through. They were going to be cornered against this large body of water. But instead, as they walked in faith, what happened? You know the story. The Red Sea parted. And that's when their faith was strengthened. The same thing happened when they were going into Israel and God parted the Jordan. God told them to march around Jericho. It seemed impossible to do that. But he said, no, take the first step. Take the first step of faith. That's when our faith grows. And so I want to encourage you, as I've been challenged, I challenge you to step out in faith. And I don't know where that is in your life. Maybe it's a relationship that you're having difficulty with and you need to go deal with it. Or a situation at the office, or a difficult patient, or perhaps it's that mission trip you've been putting off, or maybe a difficult situation with your child, or some opportunity for ministry. And it's going to be a step of faith. Maybe it's a financial risk. I don't know what God is pushing you to do, but you know what you need to do. And it's to take that radical step, to step out in faith, and God will work in you and through you for His purposes. That's my prayer for you as we finish this issue of Christian Doctor's Digest. I know He's going to use you in new ways as you become more radical in your faith for Him. Well, till we get an opportunity to get together, our prayer is God will bless you and use you in new ways. And if there's anything that we can do here at CMDA, we are here to serve you. Give us a call. Drop us a note. We're happy to help. God bless.
Christian Doctors Digest is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on Christian Doctors Digest are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations.